international finance law applied. This is international finance law. This is a contracts class, it's a transaction class, this is a deal class. What we're looking at are the largest financial markets in the world and how governments and the largest companies in the world borrow and lend money. We're specifically going to examine the international syndicated loan market, the international bond market, as well as the shorter duration euro note market. We'll mention the basic core underlying markets, but what we're now going to do is we're going to move on and focus on the other more advanced specialist aspects of international finance and of the international financial system. We're specifically going to be looking at international project finance, international infrastructure finance, international securitization, structured finance, including, for example, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, which was the background to the global financial crisis. We need to understand that against the other markets in what we call asset-backed securities, as well as, for example, the collateralized loan obligation market, CLOs, collateralized bond obligations, CBOs, collateralized equity obligations, CEOs, and then collectively, we call these CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. We need to understand all of this, including other core instruments such as, for example, credit-linked notes, credit default swaps. And we'll understand how all of this builds into the wider changes in finance, structured finance, as well as the financial derivatives markets. We'll specifically look at financial derivatives in terms of the core early contracts, futures, options and swaps. We'll distinguish these from other forward contracts, and then we'll look more specifically at credit default swaps and credit derivatives and the credit derivatives market. This is an exciting area. This is an important area. These markets are so large. This is where all the companies in the world and the governments in the world borrow and lend money. Because these markets are so large, there is no agency or entity big enough to actually control or regulate these markets. So how do they regulate, control themselves? They do it on a self-regulatory basis. So we need to understand how this market actually works and operates in practice. Essentially, the core element is standard documentation. The largest law firms in the world are instructed by the largest financial institutions in the world. They prepare standard documentation, which is now codified under the work of the key trade associations in these areas, and we'll look at the work of some of the core trade associations, Loan Market Association, LMA in lending, the International Capital Markets Association, ICMA in bond markets, capital markets, and the ISDA, International Swaps and Derivatives Association, in the derivatives area. We'll look at their contribution, we'll look at their work, we'll look at the standard documents that they make available in the markets. These are the largest markets in the world, but they operate without any fixed, comprehensive, substantial form of direct government intervention, government regulation. They essentially regulate themselves. There are some aspects of residual regulation, but again, part of that is dealt with on a self-regulatory basis. So we have codes of conduct, for example, in relation to the global foreign exchange markets, the international the money markets, as well as in the metals markets, the precious metal markets, gold, silver, platinum. We can understand all of this as well. This is just another aspect of these trade associations preparing their own codes of conduct and rules which supplement the standard documentation, which is the key mechanism for managing and regulating these markets. So we need to understand how all of this works. What I've provided on the system is a core introduction to the course as a whole. So what are we looking at? We're looking at all of the key markets. We're looking and considering structure and documents, parties' rights and duties, party liability, limitation or exclusion of liability, and remedy. We're going to examine the key structures and finance options available, core terms and conditions, and related legal issues. The core sets of contracts we're looking at are the loan markets, the bond markets, project finance markets, securitization, and structured finance is a form of secondary or supplemental securitization, and then the financial derivatives markets. Within that, we need to understand euro loans, euro bonds, euro notes, commercial paper, and financial derivatives. The background to all of this in terms of the City of London, coffee houses, financial markets, euro dollar markets, Bretton Woods, all of that is dealt with in the core introductory material I've provided, and we'll look through and highlight some of the key points of all of this, but everything's in the materials which have been made available. The key point to stress is this. All of these contracts, all of these transactions are based on a core underlying structure which is simply replicated across the markets. And then within these outlines, we've got the standard documentation, and then the standard documentation will contain a number of key terms which is simply repeated and revised over the different transactions, over the different deals, over the different sort of structures that we're looking at. And if you understand all of the basics, you understand all of the core content of this, you'll understand everything. So you will not be professionally or academically taken by surprise when you look at specific live documents, specific live deals or live transactions. All that will simply represent are revisions, adjustments or possibly omissions of the core standard terms and conditions that we would expect. And how do we know what to expect? Because it's in these key master documents that are prepared by the major law firms acting for the core trade associations in this market. These are the largest markets in the world. Total value of the global financial system is something like $425 trillion. Most of that wealth is in these markets, and then other assets which are managed by the counterparties, intermediaries in these markets. So this is what we need to understand. See how all of this comes together. The core three sets of provisions we need to look at when we're considering any specific set of documentations and any particular set of transactions are the financials, the conditions or obligations, and the events of default. Those are the three key sets of provisions in any deal. And again, we're going to come back and look at all of this in further detail. We'll look at all of the key financial terms, we'll look at the key obligations, and we'll look at the key events of default. The obligations are essentially based on three sets of core ideas. We have what we call the conditions precedent, CPs. We have the representations and warranties, the reps and Ws. And we have the covenants or the covs. The conditions precedent are pre-loan. The reps and warranties are pre-advance, drawdown under the loan. And the covenants are continuing obligations after the deals have been entered into. What we then do is this. We tie these obligations into the events of default. So if we understand all the core sets of default provisions, we know and can advise our clients on all of the remedies and the rights and obligations which apply in any particular deal, in any particular transaction. So in all cases, we come back to three core sets of provisions. The financials, the obligations, and the defaults. Everything else simply extends and applies and develops all of this. We will mention specifically the euro-dollar markets and the background to the euro-dollar markets. We have an underlying interbank market, which allows banks to buy and sell money amongst themselves. And then from that, we have two core markets. We have the international syndicated loan market, and we have the international bond market. A government or a company can raise funds, and these are very large amounts. We're talking, you know, millions, hundreds of millions, billions. You can raise it either by entering into a loan document with not one bank, it will be a group of banks, what we call a syndicate, or the same debt, the same amount, you can raise it by issuing bonds, security instruments in the capital markets. So you can either go loan market or bond market. In the loan market, all of the banks could lend the amount involved, but they won't want to. They want to spread the risk, they want to manage the risk. So the larger the amount, the more banks you'll have involved. They form groups, they form clubs, they form syndicates. So for example, if you're lending 100 million, very typically, you'll have 10 banks lending 10 million each. And as I've said, it's not that one bank can't afford it, it's that the banks just want to spread the risk. Now the key point simply is this, just before we move on. Where does that 100 million come from? What I've just said is any one of the banks could lend it anyway. Why? Where does that money come from? The money simply comes from the underlying interbank market, which supports these markets anyway. All that happens is this. The banks are not waiting, sitting on funds that they're going to lend out. These aren't deposit funds that they make available. What happens is this. When a bank enters into a syndicated loan, it waits until the agent bank, and I'll cover all of this, instructs the bank that there's to be a drawdown under the facility, and next Friday you have to pay a certain amount. Your total commitment will be, say, 10 million. Very often, the borrowers won't draw down, and there's usually more than one. There'll be a parent bank, a parent company, and usually a whole set of subsidiaries, 2, 5, up to 9, 10 subsidiary companies will all draw down. So the banks wait until they're advised by the agent bank that manages the facility that funds are to be drawn down, to be made available on a certain day. For example, next Friday morning at 10 o'clock. What then happens simply is this. Once each of those 10 banks is advised of how much it needs to lend, it then goes into the market itself and it borrows it. And it then makes it available through the facility. And the margin it makes, the profit it makes, is the difference between the cost it pays on the interbank market and what it charges the customer. The banks aren't just sitting with large amounts of money in accounts that they will on-lend as they're requested. Because these markets are so large, because they're wholesale markets, and because it's all based on these underlying lending systems, interbank systems, the banks will only actually go and raise the funds that they need to lend once they're advised it's to be made available. And that whole 100 million will ultimately not come from the deposit base of any of these banks. It will simply come from the interbank markets, which support these big, large, powerful markets. And we'll come back and we'll look at the structure of the markets in further detail. So, what we need to understand is this. The core sets of provisions, the financials, the obligations and the defaults. We then have the syndication provisions. That's the relationship between the banks that are making up these syndicates. And then in the Eurobond deals, there's other specific issues which arise. We have the managers, we have the bondholders meetings, we can have a bondholder trustee in large deals. We can also look at issues such as negotiability, listing, and then depositories and custody. And we'll try and come back and mention as much of this as we can. That's the core basic background structure to the international finance system from a legal perspective. What we then have is this. There's a number of special contracts or other more advanced specific areas. So we're going to be looking at project finance, asset-backed finance, we can also call that securitization. And then securitization, we can do secondary or re-securitization, we call that structured finance. That's transferring instruments from the banking markets into the lending markets. A bank, for example, will have a whole large portfolio in its banking book, huge loan portfolio. It will have student loans, it will have car loans, it will have residential mortgages, it will have real estate contracts, it will have a whole series of lease finance contracts, a whole series of lending commitments, all structured on its balance sheet. What it can do is this. If it wants to realise the current value of that immediately, rather than wait, for example, if it's a car loan, 5 years. Or if it's finance, consumer-type finance contracts tend to be very short. Televisions and things like that, 2 years or 5 years. Student loans tend to be very long, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Mortgages, typically 40 years. Car loans, maybe 5 years. There's a whole series of variations in these contracts. But what the bank can do is this. It can realise, I want to execute, I want to today obtain the full current value of that portfolio for whatever period is left for its residual duration, right? So what we can do is this. We can securitise the portfolio. What that means is this. We're going to take standard contracts on identical legal terms and conditions, because each one of these contracts by itself isn't worth that much. One student loan isn't worth much. One car loan, one residential mortgage, or one lease finance, corporate lease finance deal isn't worth much by itself. And also they're difficult to sell, because if we're going to sell them, a new bank has to re-undertake the original credit assessment that the first bank made, and then it's going to want a discount. And if we have a very large discount, a deep discount, we call that a fire sale. Very often banks buying assets from other banks want big discounts, and we call that a fire sale. Maybe 60%, 70%. But what we can do is this. If all of these contracts, so each contract by itself is economically almost useless. However, if they're all pooled together, if they're all governed by an identical set of common legal provisions, we can then realise the economic value of the pool as a whole. Not each individual item in the pool, but the pool as a whole. That's what securitisation is about. So what we do is we pool assets into these collective pools, and we're going to transfer them. We're going to sell them. And what's going to happen is this. Each bank will have, it won't set them up, it will already have a whole series of structures available for this purpose. It will have its own SPVs, special purpose vehicles, that it can sell these portfolios to. And what's going to happen is the SPV is going to purchase the portfolio, and how is it going to pay for it? It's going to pay for that by issuing new notes into the market, usually medium-term notes, 5-year notes, 10-year notes, 15-year notes. But let's say the pool is worth 100 million. The SPV is going to issue 100 million worth of new notes, and the income that it receives from used notes are going to be paid back to the originating bank to pay for the purchase of the pool. It's almost genius the way it works. And the banks don't do this once, they'll do it multiple times. And then the duration of the notes will be tied back to the duration of the pool. Is it a 5-year pool, a 10-year pool, or a 20-year or a 40-year pool? But this is how it's done. But what we can also do is this, and we'll come on and look at that. That's the structured finance. That's the basic core securitization. And then on top of that, we build the structured finance. The structured finance is the re-securitization or the secondary securitization of these asset pools that we've created. So, for example, we can have each chair in this room could be a single securitization. Each chair represents 5,000 somethings. Student loans, car loans, residential mortgages, real estate contracts. What we can do is, because they're all with the same bank, governed by identical documentation, we can transfer those assets as a whole to a new entity. That new entity is a special purpose vehicle, an SPV. This SPV is going to be a shell company and a shelf company. Now, what that means is this. We're literally going to buy it off the shelf. We just purchase it off the shelf. What will happen is your law firm will have a whole series of contacts, usually with law firms or accountancy firms in offshore financial centres. Turks and Caicos, Barbados, any of the offshore financial centres you can imagine. And all that simply happens is you'll just send an email, need to purchase a new company, you buy it off the shelf. It's also a shell company, which means it can do anything. It's all ready to use, it can carry on any type of activity because it's got a standard set of memorandum and articles of association. So it's a shelf company and a shell company. And at this level of work, what will also happen is when you buy it, you're actually buying it with local directors pre-appointed and usually shareholders as well. And this will all be arranged in this local domestic jurisdiction because they will have other parties, individuals or other companies that can act as the shareholders, so everything is ready to use. And the cost of doing this will just be dependent upon how much other ancillary service is provided with this. So you can literally create a company in minutes. It's a shelf company because you buy it off the shelf, and it's a shell company because it can do anything. In the project finance area, what we may then do is we might look at the memorandum and articles and narrow them so we only are involved in the specific project that we're doing, the project activities. Although in project finance, it's not that important to the same extent. Certainly in the securitization deals, so we need to understand this. In both a project finance deal and in a securitization deal, we're going to use SPVs. But in the securitization deal, to make the projects economically viable, we need to separate the SPV from the originating bank. This is not as important in the project finance deal, but it becomes crucial in the securitization deal. And we'll come back and look at this in further detail. Economically, the securitization is only going to work if we can get high quality notes issued by the SPV. And to get very high quality notes, usually AAA notes, we need to separate legally the SPV from the originating bank. Now, the SPV could still be owned by the originating bank, but there's legal devices we can use to separate this. So, for example, we can have trustee shareholders who hold the shares in the SPV in Turks and Caicos, British Virgin Islands, whatever, and they'll hold as beneficial owner on behalf of the originating bank. So legally we have a division, but still economically it's actually owned and directed by the same bank. There's devices that we can use, there's always things that we can consider. So what we've got is this. We've got the project finance market is the key infrastructure market in the world. This is how we build any form of large engineering plant of any form. It could be hospitals, it could be hotels, it could be desalination plants, power stations, nuclear power stations, it could be rockets, it could be anything, it could be information systems, anything, any large public type of infrastructure area we can fund through project finance. The key thing with project finance is that it is principally non-recourse. And non-recourse means that nobody is going to repay the debt. But how can we build $100 million projects if no one's going to pay for it? What pays for it is the future income stream that the project creates. If we build an oil refinery, the income that we're going to generate by recycling oil, and then it's not just oil. Remember, if you have oil, you have also the sub-products, the plastics and everything else, the fertilizers and everything that comes out of oil. There's a whole series of side-products that come out when you recycle oil. It's not just petrol and it's not just the gas. We're going to sell all of that. The income that that generates is going to pay for the construction. We're going to build hotels that we don't have to pay for. Why? Because the future income stream that the hotel generates is going to repay the cost of building the hotel in the first place. That's how project finance works. That's major infrastructure construction around the world is always principally financed through project finance. It's called non-recourse for that reason. There's no recourse to one specific company. It's not like there's a borrower. It's the SPV does the borrowing. In practice, there's all sorts of credit enhancement, credit supplements, and we'll come back and look at this. In the real world, it's partial non-recourse. It's not usually fully non-recourse. But as soon as you see non-recourse, you immediately think that's a project finance deal. If we're transferring assets, it's a securitization deal. And then on the securitization, as we said before, we're moving assets from the banking market into the securities markets. But what we can then do is this. Once we've transferred these assets over, we can then securitize again. So all of the income streams from all of the notes that we've issued by the SPV to purchase the underlying pool, we can re-securitize those. So, in this room, each chair is a securitization. Each chair consists of 5,000 or 10,000 assets. We're going to securitize all of those to an SPV, and the SPV is the table on each of these chairs. Each table is an SPV. But what we can then do is this. All of the income streams created under the notes issued by each of these SPVs, we can re-securitize. So we have another SPV, this screen, this monitor, is the SPV above each of these SPVs. It's a pyramid. And what's going to happen is this. This monitor is going to purchase all of the income streams from each of these SPVs. We call that secondary securitization or re-securitization. And how is it going to pay for it? It's going to do exactly the same. It's going to issue new notes into the market. But it becomes a little more complex in this case because this is becoming very large. Each one of these might be worth $10 or $20 million. We could have 100, 200, 350 of these to be sold to this SPV. So it's going to be raising hundreds of millions, if not billions, of new notes which it has to sell into the market. Because that's a lot larger, it's a lot more complex, what we then do is this. We talk about tranching. So this new SPV isn't going to issue one class of notes. It's going to issue at least three classes of notes. High quality, medium or mezzanine, and low quality. At least three, and then within each of those, we may have two or three subclasses. So this SPV may issue, let's say, 10 lots of notes. And what's going to happen is investors are going to buy the notes depending upon the risk attached to each. And the higher the risk, the higher the return. And this is how the market works. All of the investment community, which is principally pension companies, life companies, insurance companies, other asset managers, hedge funds, all the asset managers in the world, all the wealth managers in the world, they're going to purchase notes from these big, powerful SPVs. And they're going to decide according to their own investment portfolios, investment plans, investment strategies. We want a certain amount at this grade, we want a certain amount at that grade, and a certain amount at this grade. So they will purchase these notes. The core idea, mainly, principally, is to get AAA rated, very low risk, high yielding notes. And we can do that because of the credit support that we're going to set up as well, and we'll come back and look at that in further detail. If all of these assets in this large securitization and then secondary resecuritization are the same, the structure is named after the asset pool. So if they're all bonds, this becomes a collateralized bond obligation, a CBO. Why is it collateralized? Because it's secured against all of the underlying transactions in each of the underlying portfolios which make up each of the securitizations within the larger pool, right? So it's collateralized. If they're all bonds, it's a CBO. If they're all loans, it's a CLO. If they're all equity, it's a CEO. If there's any mixture, or we just want to have a general collective term, it's called a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation. It's a debt obligation that's held by the SPV, but it's made up of a large number of separate securitizations. What we do in the first case, under securitization and securitization law, we securitize bank assets. In secondary securitization, resecuritization, or structured finance, we securitize securities. So that's the secondary securitization. But what we can then do is this. We don't have to finish there. This is the SPV. The SPV, we can then have, say, 35 CDOs. And we can securitize those to another monitor at the next level above. That's called a squared, a CDO squared. And what we can then do, we can take maybe, say, 5, 10, 15 of these, and we can resecuritize them at the next level above. So we have 3, 4 different levels of debt. And that's called a cubed, a CDO cubed. Now, there's some important law here. Let's mention this now. We'll come back to it in further detail later. In each of these cases, at the underlying securitization level, we need to transfer the assets up and the risk down. What we're trying to do is set up a deal whereby there's very little risk so that the investors don't bear risk and the originating bank doesn't bear any risk. So what we normally do is we transfer the assets up. In practice, we'll do that through equitable assignments. We're going to assign each of the loans in the underlying pools up to the immediate SPV. So there'll be 5,000 assignments, 10,000, 12,000, 6,000, 4,000, whatever the size of each pool is. So we legally assign the asset up to the SPV, we transfer the title up, which also moves the risk. Now the problem is this, when we then get up to the level of the CDO, which is going to be, for example, 350 securitizations, and each one of these is 10,000 transactions, we're already looking at 3.5 million up to 35 million transactions. Do we want to have that many equitable assignments? In practice, generally no. And then certainly when we get to the squares and the cubes, do we want equitable assignment? No. It just becomes completely impracticable because we're then talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions of transactions. And do we want to have separate equitable assignments for every one of these? No. In that case, we create what we call a synthetic. And in the case of the synthetic, what we're doing is this. We're trying to transfer the risk up of the risk down without transferring the title up. And the way we can do that very simply is this, and it borders on the genius. Instead of having millions or tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of equitable transfers to transfer all these assets up in all these different stages within the CDO squared and the CDO cubed, all we do is this. We transfer the risk down. Instead of having hundreds of millions of equitable transfers, all separately documented, we can transfer the risk down by having one credit default swap. The SPV at the top will sell one credit default swap down to the originating bank. That transfers all the risk back. The SPV says, we will bear all the risk. Any loss on this portfolio, this pool, we will bear all of that. You've got no loss. We can do it through synthetics. And we'll come back and we'll look at that in further detail in the diagrams I'm going to give you. That's the hardest, the most difficult thing we're going to be looking at. And what we'll also do is we'll look at some of the particular structures that were set up just before the global financial crisis. We'll look at some of the Goldman Sachs deals, the Abacus deals, and some of the other transactions which are actually done. And I'll give you some tables and diagrams to show how this actually worked in practice. All the different parties and all of the things that were involved. It becomes very interesting, very exciting. What actually happened was this. Just before the global financial crisis, beginning in 2007, 2008, we had created almost perfect market conditions. We had created almost a perfect world. We had massive amounts of liquidity, global liquidity. You could borrow almost unlimited amounts of money for almost any purpose at almost zero cost anywhere in the world by summer 2005. And most of it was supported by this, these structured finance markets and securitization markets. It then, unfortunately, then completely collapsed. Why? Because a number of parties in the markets pushed things too far. But it was, everybody was involved. There was self-certification loans at the bottom of the markets. Companies were taking on too much debt. Governments were taking on too much debt. The authorities saw all this. They could see everything happening. There was explosions in residential house prices and other asset quality. And the authorities didn't do anything. The regulators didn't step in, the central banks didn't step in, they just watched all of this rise and rise and rise till eventually it exploded. And that's what caused the global financial crisis. There was no single specific cause of fault. Almost every party at every level was involved in some way. But what had happened was we had created almost perfect market conditions. Financial nirvana, heaven on earth, by summer 2005. But then it was just lost. We will get back eventually. The problem now is we have all of these other major geopolitical and other contingent exogenous threats and events to deal with. And if there's time, we can come back and mention some of these, but it's not directly relevant to the course. But we have a whole series of issues now with biological threats and pandemics, with possible like solar events, physical events, tsunamis and earthquakes. And then we have climate events, climate crisis, atmospheric problems. We have market events, regulatory failure. We have other technological issues. And then we have geopolitical risk, including warfare, as, for example, with Ukraine and possibly Taiwan and other issues such as that. Within the papers that I'm working on, in terms of all the stuff I've published, those six areas of what I call exogenous risk, we can summarise all of that in terms of SMARTS, SMARTS. Social, market, atmospheric is climate, regulatory, technology, safety, security and stability. SMARTS, STARTS, CHARTS, it's all the same thing. It's a list of contingent exogenous threats which we have to deal with. And if we can get over that, we might get back to these almost perfect financial conditions that we had in summer 2005. But we'll come back and look at some of this. So, we also then need to understand the financial derivatives markets. We've already mentioned credit default swaps, so we'll be looking at early future swaps and options, then the credit derivatives markets, and then the other hybrid derivative markets that have evolved over time. All of this principally begins in the early 1970s, in particular following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, and I'll come back and mention that in a couple of minutes. What had actually happened was we had a stable international financial system. We designed a new international financial order after the Second World War. This was protected and set out in the Bretton Woods Treaty, July 1944, that was agreed at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, which is a small town just in, I think it's Connecticut, north of Boston. And we agreed a new post-World War international financial order. We established the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. We established the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which becomes the World Bank Group. We tried to set up an international trade organization, an ITO, but the Americans didn't like it, the French didn't like it, so instead we adopted what we called the GATT, the G-A-T-T, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which will eventually become the World Trade Organization in 1985. But all of this was agreed and designed at the Bretton Woods Treaty in July 1944, which led to IMF, World Bank, GATT, which then becomes the WTO. The post-World War international financial system was all designed as part of the Bretton Woods Conference. This system lasts, creates international currency stability between 1944 and 1971. It lasted 44 to 71. But what then happened was the American government was under pressure, mainly because of the Vietnam War, rising costs, and it had to abandon the earlier fixed currency exchange system that was set up under the Bretton Woods Treaty. And Richard Nixon, the then president, announces this on a radio address, a monthly radio address to the American people. This was on 15th August 1971. And what he basically said was at the end of this address, "Oh, and by the way, we need to close the gold window." Under the Bretton Woods Treaty, what we had done is this: we had created a dollar exchange gold standard. Dollar exchange gold standard. And what that meant was we fixed the value of all the currencies in the world to the dollar, and the dollar's fixed to gold at $36 per ounce. Before that, we had other exchange standards. For example, we had a sterling exchange standard. All the countries in the Commonwealth would fix the value of their currencies to sterling, and sterling was fixed to gold. Before that, we had a pure gold standard where all the currencies in the world were fixed directly to gold, and the gold market was managed out of London for 300 years with the Bank of England at the centre of this. This was partly why London was the centre of the international financial system. This system was then replicated on the basis of a dollar exchange standard under the Bretton Woods Treaty. So we fixed the value of all the currencies to the dollar, and then the dollar to gold between 1944 and 1971. We tried to replace it. A committee of 20 was set up between 71 and 73, but that failed. So we basically go on to fully floating currencies from 1974 onwards. And by complete coincidence, what is this the beginning of? The modern financial derivatives markets. Because the financial derivative is essentially created to manage all of the new risk that this instability led to. Suddenly, for the first time, we have massive foreign currency risk, we have massive interest rate risk, and a whole series of other risks. So we had to manage all of this, so this is the beginning of the modern financial derivatives market. This is the beginning of the modern world. All the risk and instability we have in the world all began on 15th August 1971. So we'll come back and we'll look at all of that. Now, there are other types of transactions. We have what we call title finance, is leasing, as well as aircraft finance and shipping finance. We've also got acquisition finance, where we're raising funds to buy and sell companies. We've also got secured finance, where we're lending on security terms. We have state finance, and then we're going to deal with structured finance as part of our securitization structure. So these are all the specialist markets we're going to mention. We're also going to build into this what we call the AIM, alternative investment markets. AIM, that's high risk, high yield markets, basically hedge funds. private equity markets, sovereign wealth funds. We'll come back and mention some of this as well, so that we can understand and cover all the main markets in the world. Also on the system, you'll get materials on stock markets and exchanges. We build in legal opinions, financial remedies, and private international law as well. We'll build in all of these issues to the extent that they're relevant to the international financial system, so that we can try and understand how all of this works, how all of this operates. Now, the basic markets themselves, we can understand in terms of this table. And then on the back of the table, I've actually included some of the key values as well. And then we can update those. Those are the footnotes which support that before. We can update each of these again so we can get the most recent up-to-date figures. But it's actually very interesting to see how all of this works. This is also covered in the core materials that you've got. You have a basic key background document to the whole course, all the issues that we're looking at. So, history of banking and finance, banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking, investment banking. All of that's dealt with here. We've got the international financial system, the gold standard, Bretton Woods Treaty, the petrodollar markets, which erupted after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, Asia and Russian oil crisis, crises, and then the credit crisis, 2007 to 2010. The main point about the petrodollar market simply was this. When the Bretton Woods system collapsed, what was the most important international commodity contract that was denominated in dollars? Oil. So what happened was they put up the price of oil substantially in 73, 74, and then again in 79. That creates what we call, it leads to the petrodollar crisis. It creates what we call petrodollars. Suddenly, a lot of countries across the world, in particular in the Middle East, countries like Abu Dhabi, were very poor. They only had sand with almost no industrial production of any form whatsoever. It was only until the late 1960s, 1970s, they actually discovered oil. But what then happened was the price of these oil contracts are multiplied massively in the early 70s and then again in the late 70s. So what happened was these countries, which originally had very little income, suddenly became amongst the richest countries in the world. We call that petrodollar. They had all of this oil, they could sell into a massively expanding, growing, exploding in price international oil market. So we had all these petrodollars. Where did the petrodollars go? They came into London. Because London emerges after the Second World War as the principal international financial centre. For what? For the euro-dollar markets. The euro-dollar markets are the specialist markets which arise after the Second World War, whereby we can buy and lend almost any currency anywhere in the world. Now, specifically, euro dollar meant moving funds from America, North America, to Europe, and in particular, London. It wasn't actually euro dollar, it was London dollar, but we called it euro dollar collectively. There's actually a story that one of the first fax machines in this market at the very beginning in the 1958, after the restoration of currency convertibility, which was 1958 after the Second World War, the first fax address that was used in this market had euro-dollar. This was the bank's telex address, euro-dollar. A lot of people say that's where this actually came from. But what it meant was this. We're going to borrow in a currency outside the currency of issuance. So London becomes not the most important financial centre, the second most important after New York. The dollar becomes the most important currency ahead of sterling. But what will then happen after the Second World War, London will re-emerge as the principal international financial centre. Why? Because all the large American banks will move from, not they don't move from, but they will set up branches in addition to their existing New York and other American operations. They all move to London and create new operations in London. And with that, they bring massive dollar investments. So they move all of these new dollars over to London, and London will re-emerge after the Second World War as the principal international financial centre. Initially, as a market for dollar debt. But very quickly, what will happen is this. The term euro-dollar will come to mean borrowing in any currency outside the country of issuance. So, A euro deal in London is euro dollar. A renminbi deal in London is euro dollar. A dollar deal in London is euro dollar. But a sterling deal in London is just a domestic. A dollar deal in Frankfurt is euro dollar. A dollar deal in Hong Kong is euro dollar. But a euro deal in Frankfurt, Paris or Amsterdam is a domestic. So euro dollar now means any international finance which is raised in a currency outside the country of issuance. This market is based on an underlying what we call a placement market, a deposit market, and then from that we get the two markets I mentioned before, the international syndicated lending market and the international bond market. Now, all of this is dealt with, explained in this core background paper, as well as in a separate specialist euro-dollar market paper. So this is the euro-dollar paper. And then there's also another paper on the City of London, which explains the importance of London and the London markets. And at the end of this, it also goes into the background to the origins of many of the London markets in terms of coffee houses. Many of the largest markets in the world all began in coffee houses in the City of London in the 1660s, 1670s and 1680s, 1690s. What had happened was Pasquale Rosi brings coffee to London for the first time in 1652. The first coffee shop was actually opened in Oxford on the High Street by Jacob. It's now called the Grand Café in Oxford in 1650. Just opposite that, a couple of years later, there's the Queen's Coffee House. The Queen's Coffee House claims to be the oldest continuous coffee shop in London, in England. It is. But the first wasn't Queen's because it was opened 2 years after. Jacob's, which opened before on the High Street in Oxford, in the Grand Café. And you can still see that. It's still a beautiful place to go and have tea, afternoon tea. What then happened was these early coffee shops in London expand very quickly. There's over 3,000 of them created within 100 years. This becomes a new coffee culture. And the whole point simply was this. The coffee houses emerged as principal places of business. There was nowhere else to go to conduct business. If you were wealthy, you had your own house, so you would invite guests. But there was no office premises. There was no commercial premises available for office and business purposes. And remember, there was no internet, there was no television, there was nothing at this point. And the first newspapers, many of those actually began by the proprietors and the coffee houses creating their own newspapers. What happens is these coffee shops emerge as centres of business. This becomes how business is actually conducted. So many of the largest markets in the world will actually evolve out of these coffee shops. Lloyd's of London was Edward Lloyd's coffee shop, 1688. London Stock Exchange, Jonathan's coffee shop, 1660, 1670. The Baltic Exchange was the Jerusalem and Baltic coffee shops. A lot of the main markets all began in these coffee shops, these coffee houses. And all of this takes place at the same time as we have this larger transformation in Britain with what we call the Financial Revolution. And the Financial Revolution is the creation of the modern economy, the modern state, modern parliamentary system. What had happened was we had to replace, or the English decided they wanted to replace, the Scottish Catholic kings, which had run England and Scotland together since the Union of the Crowns in 1603. We then had the Union of the Parliaments in 1707. The English decided they didn't want Scottish Catholic kings and queens running England, so they invited William of Orange to come over with his Queen Anne in 1688. But the condition for this was that the new king and queen respect the power of Parliament. This is the beginning of modern parliamentary democracy, and it was all created in Britain at this time. The condition for the new monarchy being established was set out in what we call the Bill of Rights, 1689, and Claim of Rights in Scotland, which determines the relationship between the King and the Queen and Parliament. The King and the Queen can no longer start wars on their own and then fund them by raising tax and have unlimited royal prerogative. For the first time ever, we're going to create a modern democracy, a modern government. We're also going to raise funds for the government through public debt programs, through what we call early consols, which are the beginning of the bond market. We're also going to support all of this with a formal, basic civil service and a modern government structure. At the same time, we've got all the beginning of the new private markets, which began in the coffee houses, at exactly the same time, by complete coincidence. All of this comes together. Britain becomes Great Britain, and then the centre of the British Empire, and then the British Commonwealth, because of this. It's not the Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution won't come for another 60 years. The Industrial Revolution was very important, and British, and in particular Scottish inventors, invented some of the most important parts of this, but that's not what made Britain great. What made Britain great was the earlier financial revolution, 1688 onwards, which occurs at the same time as the coffee houses. So, the background to a lot of all of this is in the court supplemental documents you've got on the City of London and on the Eurodollar markets. All of the structure and operation of the early markets, all explained in here. And a lot of the reading, other information, key points of interest, as well as materials, is all referred to in this paper as well on the Eurodollar markets. So you've core documents on City of London and on the Eurodollar markets, by way of background to all of the larger examination of the international financial system we're looking at. All of that is then set out in this other core document, Introduction to International Finance Markets Law and Practice. Within this, apart from the gold standard, Bretton Woods, petrodollars, Asian and credit crisis, we've already mentioned, we've also got the international financial markets. So we need to understand the money markets, the capital markets, the euro-dollar markets, the derivatives markets, currency markets, gold market, commodity markets, and insurance markets. All of that's explained in the paper. Financial assets and instruments. What I wanted to do was this. Go back over the markets, look at all of the particular types of instruments, assets, and claims, and then look at each of these. So I structured it in terms of five core ideas: coinage and currency, credit and payment, public debt, corporate securities, risk and investment assets. Within each of those, identify around five separate instruments. So what we can understand is this. We can look at the markets in section 3, and then all of the instruments dealt with in the markets in section 4. So you read those two, you'll understand almost everything. And then again, we're going to come back and look at the structure of the international financial system on the table I've already provided, which is separately available on the system, this one. But also in this background document, we're also going to look at the nature of international financial centres and the important functions that they carry out: international banking, investment banking, international bonds, equities, foreign exchange, derivatives, asset management, gold bullion and insurance and marine services. A lot of this based in London. Then global investment banking business, what are the key functions that investment banks carry out? Equity and debt underwriting, market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange and financial derivatives, prime brokerage and other activities. Prime brokers are working for hedge funds. Hedge funds are just asset managers, they're wealth managers, basically set up as SPVs in offshore financial centres. They then develop very powerful, aggressive investment strategies to raise billions, tens of billions, but they can't do all of this themselves. So they will have a prime brokerage relationship with one of the major investment banks. And what that will include is providing lending facilities, buying and selling securities, custody services, foreign currency exchange, derivatives provision, administrative custodian, all sorts of other services, a whole series of functions that the hedge fund might need to conduct its business will all be provided by usually one or two investment banks. Who was the largest, most powerful prime broker just before the global financial crisis? Lehman Brothers. And because the American authorities allowed Lehman to collapse, to fail, over the weekend of 13th, 14th September 2008, that's what caused the global financial crisis. A lot of commentators at that time, including the French president, they all thought, Sarkozy, it was caused by hedge funds. It wasn't caused by hedge funds. And many of the hedge funds actually suffered massive losses because all of their assets were tied into the investment banks, including Lehman Brothers, which had collapsed. They were actually victims of the crisis, not causers or abusers or benefiters from all of this. So the development of investment banking all of the major investment banks in the world and then identify and explain their origin and background. A lot of this goes back to the beginning of early international finance, in particular in London, but also in New York. What we had was the stock market collapse in New York in 1929, and that led to the separation of commercial banking and securities business, which becomes the new term investment banking. Investment banking is a misnomer. It's an accident of American legal English. An investment bank is not a bank. It cannot conduct banking business. It cannot hold bank accounts, take deposits and lend. That's what a bank does, a commercial bank. An investment bank is an accidental term which was created under the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act 1933 when the Americans decided to separate securities business and pure commercial banking business. This is all in the papers, all the background is in here. But what then happens is, 80 years later, with the global financial crisis, people forgot that. And this term investment bank is then all mixed up, and the term bank is all confused. Nobody realises the difference between a commercial bank and an investment bank, and then in the middle we have what we call the merchant bank. A merchant bank is a somewhat unique, older, historical, British type of bank which originally developed in the trade finance area. It was doing foreign exchange, international letters of credit business, trade finance business, so it had domestic accounts, it had deposit facilities and lending facilities. It was basically a commercial bank that moves in by accident into trade finance and then into securities business, advising on deals, issues, underwriting. So it's an old British commercial bank that moves through trade finance into investment banking. That's completely distinct from an American investment bank, which is only a securities house. The five largest investment banks on Wall Street were Goldman Sachs at the top, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and then Lehman Brothers, and then Bear Stearns. They're not banks. They are securities houses. But this all get confused in all the writing and discussion around the global financial crisis. So we need to understand that. And the historical development to all of this is explained at the beginning of the paper, and then in this section here, I explain the nature and operation of all the largest investment banks in America, Britain, Europe, and in Japan, where they have four big securities houses. I then look at commercial banking and explain the nature of that in a parallel manner. We then look at international markets. So we've got the loan market we've mentioned, we've got the bond market, we've then got the project finance market, and I summarise all of that in the paper, the securitisation, and then into the structured finance market, I summarise in the paper, and then financial derivatives as well. All of this is provided for in this core background paper to the course. Now, there's some other ancillary materials provided. There's a basic introduction to the course. I've also provided some information about other sources of work. You don't need to buy anything. Everything will be provided for you. You've essentially got a draft chapter for each of the core parts of the course taken from my draft book on international finance law. We strongly encourage you to spend time developing electronic dictionaries and glossaries. And then separately, I have provided on the system a series of key websites and references. You need to become familiar with these, but also find out the best of the new ones. A lot of this changes all the time. You need to know the best electronic glossaries, electronic dictionaries, so when you need to find a term, it's on your phone, it's preloaded, you can do it in seconds. This is essential. This is really important. You don't want to go back and have paper dictionaries and handbooks, have to go to libraries. You don't need that anymore. Everything is online. Have it on speed dial on your phone so you can go straight to Investopedia and various other websites so you can get key definitions of the most important core financial terms when you need it, as you're reading, as you're working through this. You also, on the system, you'll have access to the Financial Times. You've also got The Economist, which is one of the main sources of very useful weekly information. There's a core section in The Economist, pages 80 to 90 every week, on the core financial markets. You can understand everything that's happening just by reading The Economist once a week. There's also some other great sections on technology, as well as a North American section, a European section, an Asia section, a UK section, and then the first part at the beginning highlights all the most important things which are happening at any one point. The Economist writers and the Financial Times writers are the best writers in the world. If you become familiar with these now, this will help you forever. You just go to the website, you go to the university website, you go to the law library, you go to database, you can search this, it will come up in seconds, you go straight into the data list, and then you get everything there. You've also got Westlaw, you've got LexisNexis, you've got Financial Times, Economist, all of these other main journals and magazines that you can use, you can refer to. Become familiar with them at the same time as you then build in these electronic dictionaries as well. What will also happen is when you go to work for a law firm or an investment bank or another major financial institution, you will get all the codes. So you can go to the LMA, Loan Market Association, just now. You can see most of the website. But when you go into the documentation section, you'll get the index, so you know what all the documents are, but you won't actually be able to open the documents without a code. But your law firm or your bank or the government department you work for, they will have all of these. So the first day when you go to work for a treasury, a central bank, a law firm or a big bank, the first thing you do is go straight to the library or go to the librarian, say hello, be nice, offer to buy them a cup of coffee, but get the codes. Get the LMA code, get the ICMA code, get the ISDA code and any other codes that they've got. Because then immediately on your phone, your telephone, your own personal telephone, becomes the most powerful learning tool in the world. Because you will have everything on here. And just through speed dial, you'll be able to access almost everything. When I did my transfer to the bar, I actually had a number of pages I created of all of this stuff, as well as all of the key books, all the major international books, on all and UK English books on everything. McGregor on damages, contract law, tort law, everything. I had all the best books, I had all the electronic editions of them, I had access to everything, including all the case law, mainly through Bali, is the best case law source. I had all of that on my phone. I created this kind of index for it, so I knew whenever wherever I was, at any time, I could access almost anything, anywhere. And that's what you need to do, because that's, as a professional, that's what you have to have. You don't need to have all the information in your head at any one point. Nobody can. You need to know where it is. You need to know where to be able to find it. And it's very easy to do. So strongly encourage you to do that. There's also a separate set of provisions and materials on study groups, if you want to form study groups. That's also in here. But you have all the other background documentation. You've also got a study pack for the whole of the course. So for each week, we summarise all the key issues, all the key materials that we're going to go over, all the key parts. For the purposes of this class, you need to understand the basic introductory material. So I've highlighted core reading, additional reading, and then supplemental reading, supplemental, supplemental reading. All you need to do is just watch this and mark it up yourself as we find new documents or as other very recent current papers become available. Just mark it up either electronically or in hand, simply because when you go back to revise this at the end, you know exactly what to look at. And you'll have all of this ready on your system. So we need to understand the basic background and then the markets themselves, and we're going to come on and look at that now. And then also we'll come on to look at this basic core information on the loan market, the bond market, the shorter duration instruments, which are what we call the euro note market and the commercial paper market. And then we're into project finance. Lead bank liability is the interim, the step between the bond market and the link between the bond market and the loan market. And then international project finance, international securitization, international structured finance, international financial derivatives, and then international financial regulation. And then at the end, you have a lot of key readings that you can go off and refer to. A lot of this is very good. It's the best stuff available. Some of it's quite old now. Because this is such a topical, hot, fast-changing, innovative area, it's very difficult to get something which is up to date. a lot of that you can only find by looking at articles and things. I have on the system, I've provided separate links to the key standard documentation sources that we've mentioned with the trade associations, but also I've put some other documents on which have lists of a lot of key standard documents. So sample trustees, trustee deeds, or bond issues, or all sorts of capital market type stuff, including different clauses and different kind of sample agreements. All of that's on the system as well. So you just open it, it's all set up, so you just press the links and it takes you straight to all these sample documents all around the internet. Everything you need is on the system. Everything you need is made available. You will have no difficulty keeping on top of any of this. Everything is covered in the documentation that you have. This is International Finance Law Applied.